Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. We're here in Venice, and by we, I mean me, your faithful host, and Jordan Kronk.
Hello, Nick.
Jordan is a very, very loyal servant of cinema, so much so that he has come to Venice for the first time, I think.
The very first time, yes. I typically go to TIFF, but this year decided to do Venice. For people who know, the two festivals overlap usually by a week or so. So unless you're, pretty connected or write for like a magazine or a newspaper, you probably are going to one or the other. But yeah, so I decided to do Venice this year instead.
And I mean, do you have any initial impressions or?
It's a very mellow, chill festival, which I like. It's not hard to get into screenings. It's not hard to get around. Everything's pretty centrally located. And the scheduling is amazing. It's just like so casual. I don't know why other festivals aren't like this. I feel like I have a huge gap in the afternoon every day.
It's very civilized.
Yeah. There's
something very civilized about it.
I don't know. Maybe it speaks to the programming too. Like, it's pretty clear like what the interesting or significant films are. And there's less maybe incentive to explore some of the sidebars, unfortunately, which I tend to do at other festivals. But so I've been picking my spots more than normal and kind of taking it easy. But it's been very enjoyable. Yeah.
And we are, just in case you hear any background noise, we are in this kind of open plaza that's in front of the casino, the building called the casino, where there are a number of screens. So that's what you'll be hearing, is the mirth of Venice festival goers. So we'll be talking about a recent film, a film that has just screened for the press, or relatively recently, over the weekend. I think it's already been reviewed a little, and I guess definitely one of the most anticipated films, partly because I don't think anyone had an exact clue of what it would really be comprised of, especially the more you heard about it, the less it really seemed to make sense, and that is Aggro Drift. I don't really know how to pronounce Drift as if there's a one in it, but there is a one in Drift. New movie from Harmony Korine, I guess his first since...
Beach Bum, yeah.
Which we'll pass over mostly in silence. Well, first, do you want to just give the rundown of what the specs are on this film?
What the specs, yeah. This is a narrative feature shot with infrared cameras that follows very casually a hitman on, I guess, what proposes to be May's final job. It's very simple, threadbare narrative. Basically, a hitman on his last job. He wants to spend more time with his family. But I don't know, talking about the plot doesn't really make a lot of sense with this movie. It's very just, it's like a sensory experience. The entire film, like I said, is shot with like thermal infrared cameras, which I guess in layman's terms picks up the heat in the image rather than the light, what a regular camera would. So you're seeing all these various bright fluorescent type colors.
Yeah. If you remember Predator.
Yes, it looks like Predator. Exactly. It looks like Predator.
This is what Predator sees.
Yeah. But that's the entire movie is shot this. So it's very interesting visually. From what I gather, it's not uniting critics. It's, I mean, like most of Harmony's films, I feel very probably divisive. But I enjoyed it. It to me, it offers what I want in some sense out of cinema, which is a beautiful sensory, like aesthetic experience. Like I said, if you're here for like deep thematic insights, it's probably you're probably looking in the wrong place. But what else to say about it? It basically, Travis Scott is in it in a small role as like the hitman's accomplice at one point, which they basically hang out on a yacht with I don't know, strippers or
they hang out on a yacht that has also a pool in the yacht somehow, which I thought was pretty cool.
Exactly.
So they do that. I think they also go to an actual strip club at one point. There is twerking at the pool within the yacht.
Lots of twerking in the film. His wife seems to
His wife misses him.
Yes, misses him.
And talks a lot about her yearning and sort of writhes around on a bed. He also has two kids, and he just wants to be back in that warm embrace of home.
Yeah. Well, I guess the idea behind the film, from what I gather, hearing him talk about it, he wanted to kind of make a film either inspired by or replicate the experience of a video game. He's calling the film Game Core.
What did you make of that? How much does it succeed in doing that? Or in what ways does it
do that? To me, it did feel, actually, I didn't read, when I saw it, I hadn't heard about that. And I gathered that just from watching it. I'm like, it's kind of like watching someone play a video game in a sense. Mm. It's not like shot like in a POV perspective or anything, but it does have that kind of like movement to it. And, and just his goal in the film was to basically like go kill this boss character, essentially, like this gigantic, like jacked dude who is like growls and has a super deep voice, so he's like a monster type villain character that he's going to like murder to like win the game. And and there's all these other flourishes in it where like his psyche manifests in this like gigantic like goblin sea creature type thing.
It's almost, that almost shadows him in this kind of, in this opening sequence where he is like, he's strangling a guy at a pool. The demon is behind him, kind of like, not whatever the opposite of mini me is, major me is kind of echoing what he's doing. So it's kind of a bravura way to open the movie.
Yeah.
With that.
And it's mostly told in voiceover. He kind of is going through like an existential crisis. So he's saying all these very opaque, quasi, existential. I was going to say profound, but they're not profound. Yeah. But he's trying to make all these kind of like existential statements and thoughts. But
It's a weird combination of like contemplating and kind of talking himself up, but also like sort of spiraling implicitly a lot of the time. And it's also we were just talking to someone about who said, the voiceover reminds me of like a voiceover in a Malick movie, which hadn't occurred to me. But I think it's true that it is a voiceover that it doesn't just feel like a voiceover. It feels like you're in his head, but it also feels like he's talking over the images. It's unusual.
I've heard other people actually compare it to Malick too. It does have that kind of dreamy, drifty quality to it.
And just very casually spoken, but then also sometimes like insistently repeating. It's very odd.
Well, I mean, for me, what's interesting is he's like seems to be wedding the aesthetics of his recent films, Spring Breakers and The Beach Bum, kind of like the neon, very like
Miami.
Yeah, the Miami kind of look and feel, the palette of those films, with like maybe his earlier films, in the sense that like to me this film is the most like Trash Humpers of anything he's made, probably, because it has like one idea basically, and it just is going to go with it for
it
the
just
whole
humps
film.
That idea, for
yeah, basically, for yeah. So I was, if you like Trash Humpers but want it to be even more colorful, that could be up your alley. So, which I do. So this is like much more interesting to me than The Beach Bum, which I really hated. It's one of his only films I don't like, but especially coming off Spring Breakers, which I think is like one of the key films of like. The century.
Spring Breakers is big. I mean, I think he gets a lot out of his collaborations with cinematographers. It seems like, I mean, for the past 20 odd years, he kind of pairs up with a different European cinematographer.
Yeah.
And you get this kind of interesting, I don't know, hybrid of his own kind of like, whatever, skater kid rambunctiousness with an aesthetic that he crafts with whoever the cinematographer is. This particular one, I didn't recognize the name, but I did note that it's French. So it's another, it's another, like, you know, Euro DP.
Yeah, and I've heard some people say it's like, you know, it could just be a gallery piece. Like, it would change in no way if you just, like, projected it in a museum, which is true. And I think that's what he wants, to move beyond cinema, according to him. You know, he's kind of seems to be done with...
He's over it.
He's over, yeah. And you can see that. And I mean, there's no story of any note here. So the dialogue, what he's saying is very... All the characters are just saying, like, very just, like, cliche... Like, even when there's that video game element even to, like, what they say, in the sense that, like, he shoots a guy and the guy's like, oh, he shot me. Like, that's, like, literally what he says.
It's true. Yeah.
So it has that feel to it. And I feel like, I mean, there's no reason to, like, dig into the themes of the film. Like, not the themes, but just, like, dig into, the dialogue and what he's going through. It's very, like, surface level.
Yeah, it's a very, like, sensation kind of based movie. And, yeah, I mean... Accepting that, I felt the sensations. I enjoyed looking at him tooling around, working with this kind of toolbox of the thermal imaging. Because it also isn't, I mean, if I say compared to Predator, I mean, one thing about those sort of uses of infrared is that it'll click into infrared and you basically have that sort of static one-to-one, you know, translation of the world. In this case, though, he's playing with the colors, so the way they're distributed, the palette will change from one quote-unquote scene to the next. He also does the weird little sort of doodles, like CG and rotoscoping doodles, you know.
Yeah, there's some AI involved, I think, yeah. In the some of the visuals. If sometimes you see their bodies and you can see through them, and there's like a mechanical like underbelly to some of the characters, and I think that was done with like some AI technology from what I've gathered. But no, I've heard, I talked to someone that worked on the post-production of like the image when I saw the film, and he was saying it was super hands-on, and like they were like going over every color, every like, and manipulating where and when you're going to see certain colors and things like that. So it's not like just he's shooting this and it's just like being registered in this other format and that's it. It's very, it was very like, I don't know, nuanced to hands-on. And
Yeah. And it looks like that. I mean, you start, like what you see in the first shot or so, which is they really show off for like a rainbow palette. You got like a cobalt blue sky, and then you got red, you got orange, you got yellow, this kind of warm green, but then that changes as it goes on. And then the music, I think, is also a big part of the movie.
Yeah, A-Rab Music did the did the score, which is a really good score, too. It's very, like, propulsive, and it pretty much goes nonstop throughout the film.
Yeah, and that, too, I think also helps kind of just to dissolve any narrative expectations, because it's just going, again, I guess in a video game, it's just kind of, like, continuing on and on and on. And it's also keeps kind of throwing you off, because there'll be, like, samples that are kind of, they're kind of these sample-based atmospheric compositions.
Yeah.
And like the opening sample was like a sort of almost, I thought, soap opera like kind of piano motif, but given that kind of like analog work through that makes it very eerie.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's also pretty notable. And then also pretty loud at times. Like there's this falcon shriek.
Yeah.
Like it's just ear splitting falcon shriek in the first 25 minutes just jolts you. When I first heard the title, I thought, what the hell does this mean? But the more when I was writing about it, the more it actually kind of works.
Yeah, you know?
It's like it is a movie you drift through. There is sort of a constant latent ambient violence in it.
Yeah.
So it's aggro.
And I didn't find it to be, I mean, I've heard some people complain, like, it's so tedious and long. It's like 80 minutes. And to me, it didn't really feel long. It felt like appropriate length to sit through. And it's very, like, let it wash over you. And
Yeah.
I wasn't really bothered by how long it was.
Yeah. So I don't have a problem with Harmony's provocations. I will enjoy. For some reason, a speaker has just started playing. We're also watching what looks like an entire film crew rolling by. As long as the music does not reach some sort of crescendo, we should be fine where we are. But maybe that's actually scene change music for us to go on to another title.
Sure.
And this is latest Bertrand Bonello film, The Beast. And I guess I have to say, like I was saying with Poor Things, kind of another surprise hit, I guess you'd say. Like, it's been pretty well embraced.
Sort of surprising.
Yeah. What did you make of The Beast? Or what is The Beast?
It's another one that's hard to explain, but for different reasons.
I keep lobbing those over
Thank
to you.
Thank you, yeah. No, this is, I think, the 10th film by Bertrand Bonello, one of my favorite filmmakers, so this was very anticipated for me. This is certainly his most ambitious film to date. This is a three-part film set in three different time periods, I think 1910, 2014, and 2044, if I'm not mistaken. It follows two characters played by Léa Seydoux and George MacKay, and they are basically stuck in a loop of, I don't know, falling in love or meeting and re-meeting across these eras in different reincarnations. But I guess it's easiest to start at the last period, the 2024, because Léa Seydoux is getting her DNA purified, essentially to rid her of memories and emotions. But when she does this, which entails her like laying in like a black goo bath, she is like reliving her past. So you see her in 1910, in Paris, in like a period setting, obviously, meeting the George MacKay character, whose name's Louis, I think. Yeah. They fall in love in that story. And then in 2014, it's like the more contemporary story set in Los Angeles, which I was surprised by. Yeah. And there they meet again, but this time Lea Seydoux is playing an actress slash model. Mm-hmm. And
just starting out.
Yeah, and Louis is now a, I don't know, incel potential or like murderer on the brink of killing.
Yeah, I mean, and also, correct me if I'm wrong, he's basically... seems more or less modeled on back on a particular guy.
Like, yeah, what's his name? Elliot.
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Yeah, you know,
Elliot Roger or something like that. Who did the same? Did this mass murder, but it was directed at women who like rejected him his whole life. So Louis in this section is like stalking Lea Seydoux essentially, and making these video posts on his phone, kind of like saying why he's going to get revenge on women for rejecting him and all these. Thing. So anyway, so that's the second part. And then in 2044, while she's getting this procedure done, she's also running into Louis, who's, I think, going to get the same procedure done. But this right. is set in a, kind of a futuristic landscape where there's it's very depopulated.
Yeah.
Pollution is, like, running rampant. They have to wear masks, like actual, like, these, like, virtual face mask type visors. Yeah. And AI has kind of taken over and eliminated most of the jobs for people. Mm-hmm. So it's a very... intricate complex narrative, and it's jumping between all these, so it begins kind of in the present and moves very quickly to the past and then jumps back and forth, and then not until the second half does it really have an extended period in the 2014 mm-hmm. section, which to me actually turned out to be like the most interesting stuff shot in Los Angeles. Has this very Lynchian vibe to a lot of it, which I think, I don't know, it's just osmosis. People shoot LA in like a Lynchian way, I think, just by like by default now. I feel like every movie I see there is shot like that, but it does have like Mulholland Drive slash Twin Peaks elements to it, and this is sort of like his Twin Peaks The Return, I think, in some ways. Mm. And while watching it, I remembered that I think he put Twin Peaks The Return on his Sight and Sound list this year. So I think that is an influence. There's lots of red curtains and kind of dreamy dance sequences, and the LA setting has that Lynchian vibe to it, and she's playing like an actress kind of being stalked or going through a crisis of some sort. But she's basically always, the beast is like a metaphor for something that she is always fearing that's going to happen to her. It's like an impending danger lurking in her, what she thinks is her future, and it comes to pass in various ways in all the stories, I guess.
Yeah, this dread.
Yeah, but she it takes her each story to like work through this like anxiety that she has trouble reconciling. But yeah, it's a, kind of a hard movie to completely explain, and it would give away a lot to talk about the very ending. But I did. Did you notice there was Trash Humpers clips in that?
If you hadn't mentioned it, I was going to say that.
That reminded me of it when we were talking about Trash Humpers.
But yeah,
that was not expected. There are some like excerpts from Trash Humpers.
Yeah, I saw it at first. I was like, wait a second, is that? And I was like, wow. So I love that, like, Trash Humpers, like, 14 years ago is, like, still cutting edge of what would disturb you. You know, it's like...
But no, I mean, I thought it was super ambitious and has a feel of, like, one of those French films from, like, the early 2000s sometimes to me that were, like, very interested in technology in the future, like a Demon Lover or something. And those movies were not necessarily, like, super well-received at the time, and I think now they're... thought of more positively, but this had a vibe like that to me.
That's interesting comparison to Demon Lover. Yeah, it does have that pretty dark view of the future.
Or just like a Southland Tales or Cloud Atlas, like these super like ambitious, in some cases like folly type films. I think this one doesn't fail in any spectacular way like those, or arguably those do. But yeah, to me it worked beautifully, and watching Lea Seydoux go through all these like different incarnations where she plays like radically different, or both of them play radically different characters throughout, and you kind of see this gradual like elements persist throughout all three for her.
Yeah,
George MacKay's character kind of switches like wholly, but
yeah,
you get this kind of like Eternal Return type feeling throughout while you're watching.
Definitely,
it
and,
and the way it's edited, it is very like disorienting, and there's multiple moments where like scenes cut quick and repeat, especially in the contemporary section. Like you see Lea Seydoux do something and then it kind of rewinds and plays it again real fast, or like it's a glitchy quality to some of it.
Yeah, from the very start there's this glitchiness, and it really keeps you off balance even when you think you know what it would mean to have this incel character appear and where that would lead. You know, it keeps you off balance there as well. So, yeah, this is probably one of my favorite of his films, I'd have to say, because the scope of the ambition and Seydoux is like, it's like she's running a decathlon or something. She's doing like five different, you know, things over the course of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's often, most of his films deal with like how the past is, you know, constantly in the present. You know, usually they jump, his films jump between the past and the present, but this is the first one, I believe, that goes into the future. So it's a little something different. I think maybe, I mean, it was conceptualized, I believe, during the pandemic. And I think you can see some of like the roots of some of the ideas in Coma, his previous film, mm-hmm. which dealt with young people and technology. So yeah, I'd be curious to hear more of what he is going for, like thinks about how technology is kind of taking over, because it's very like AI anxious, tense film in that way.
Yeah, and just sort of pretty matter-of-factly grim, you know, a view of what AI would realize. And I mean, maybe what he thinks AI will do, maybe it didn't occur to me until after. It's like, oh, I guess I've sort of seen that idea in another movie of how AI might impact humanity. Yeah. But the way he presents it, it feels like something original and newly unsettling.
Yeah, most of the stuff is very like casually presented. It takes you a minute to kind of see what... There's a part where she's kind of like working out to a interactive AI type thing, and it's hard to tell what she's doing for a little bit.
Yeah.
There's another part where she has like a mechanical doll of some sort. There is a doll theme throughout the film too.
Yeah.
But it just like sits there and giggles at her at various points. It's very creepy.
Yeah, it's like a little gremlin or mogwai or something.
Exactly. So yeah, there is all this different motifs. In like the older 1910 section, the Louis character is like a doll maker. And then in the 2044 section, there's a character played by the woman from St. Omer. I can't remember her name. But she plays like a living doll.
Yeah.
Like a human doll who befriends Léa Seydoux's character.
Yeah, just a year after seeing her in St. Omer here.
Yeah.
Well, since you mentioned the 1800s, that reminds me that I guess apparently a source text for this is a Henry James novella.
Yes, the Beast in the Jungle.
Did you read that? Or?
But I've noticed that's in the press notes that it was vaguely inspired by that novella, which deals with someone who I think has anxieties about some unspoken or unseen danger lurking.
Yeah.
So I think that was like maybe the inception point for it, but it jumps off way beyond that. That idea remains in all the sections.
Yeah.
So it's basically updating that for like a technophobic future.
Yeah. Yeah. As ruminative as James's paragraphs get, I don't think he managed to squeeze in AI at that point yet, although maybe he did. It's sort of also a pervasive feeling of haunting without actually bringing up the idea of a ghost, although there is a medium, a Lynchian medium that does appear at one point.
Yeah, there's mediums.
There's a little of everything.
Yeah, there's a hypnotist in one section and a medium in another. And
yes.
She's basically haunted by her past lives.
Past lives.
It's Léa Seydoux who can recall her past lives.
Yes. That's right. I was really impressed by it, and it really sticks with you, and you kind of keep churning through it in my mind. So that's The Beast, new Bonello film, and then we'll make a nice triumvirate here with another anticipated title, although a little bit sort of a bit of a quieter presence. Like I had to keep reminding myself that there was indeed a new Hamaguchi movie here, which almost suits the movie, which is itself a mostly becalmed rural set film. A movie's called Evil Does Not Exist. Although when the titles flip up at first as they flip up word by word, first it says evil does exist.
Yeah.
And then the knot comes in. I could take a crack at most of this, although I feel like there's some part of it that I'm not entirely sure about.
Sure.
But basically it's about a rural community in Japan that's pretty small. I think it's like in the thousands maybe at most. And quietly like self-sufficient. And what happens is, I love that this is the actual word. At first I thought this was a translation thing, but they do like a slideshow where there's a company that wants to start a glamping site. And I thought, oh, that's just, they're reaching for the translation. But then they do a little like presentation.
Glamping's a thing, yeah.
It's the universal language apparently of glamping. Yeah. So, but that's going to have an environmental impact. So, you know, they have a couple of reps who come and have an open forum with community, and immediately it's clear that there's going to be problems. And so it kind of works through that the couple of reps, but also like a couple of figures, like a guy who's like a all-around handyman, who's this very, very self-possessed and still kind of mysterious figure. Jack of all trades, he calls himself. There's also a guy who's a mayor. So there are all these kind of community figures, and you're just kind of tracking them. And it's almost hard to describe how this movie flows along, because it's so beautifully and subtly constructed. There's an incredible score.
Jim O'Rourke. I guess most people probably know him when he was in Wilco and Sonic Youth, but he has a large discography of like experimental synth music and just experimental electronic music. But this is like a classically made score, which is really beautiful and like runs quite often throughout.
Yeah, and it just gives this kind of, I don't know, like architecture to the film, this invisible architecture to the film, because it's really, it's at kind of the calmed pace, even as there are these tremendous, like, you know, passions and strong feelings about this development that's going to occur. Honestly, at one point I looked at my watch and I was like, suddenly like an hour is gone. Not because I was bored, but I was just kind of curious, like, because an hour is gone and it's...
Well, not much happened. It's very subtle. Like, the subtlest movie here that I've seen. And you don't really learn or understand what's going on until near the end. And that's when it really reveals itself as something greater than what I was thought I was watching. Because it starts as one thing and ends as something else. I'll say that much without spoiling it. And but yeah, it's super beautiful. Like the opening shot, I guess it's bookended by two extremely long shots with the score and just like shots of overhead shots of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And really beautiful and quiet movie. And but also actually unexpectedly like humorous at times with the with the duo of the two glamping consultants or whatever they are. They spend a lot of time in the car talking and talking about dating apps and things like this. So there's this humorous kind of camaraderie to them.
Yeah.
And they're learning about what is bothering the community about their presence. And yeah. And then this other character with his daughter becomes increasingly significant, who's kind of just, you know, begins with them, but they're always kind of in the periphery of this story. And then they become more prominent as it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also this like lurking tension throughout, because there's gunshots in the background of certain sequences, and they talk about the hunters are shooting fawn in the distance, and that becomes a more primary kind of story note as it goes along as well. It turns into like a really powerful film by the end, and it's not as outwardly like conceptual or like maybe as outwardly ambitious as Drive My Car or Asako 1 and 2, which is a very conceptual film, or Happy Hour or whatever, which is obviously quite a long film. So this is much shorter than his recent work. It's much more linear. In that way, I think it could maybe be like overlooked, or like you could take for granted its qualities or its virtues.
Yeah.
But I think they're there, and by the end, it's like it fits within his like his interests. And I don't want to give it away. But
no, me too.
It's hard to talk about the end without giving away what kind of the whole thing's dealing with, but
I'm also hesitant to talk about where it goes, because anything I'd say would sound kind of more cliche than it actually plays out, because as usual he's able to like uncover or find or reveal mystery, even as it's that building, it's the way things creep up on you, that's common to a lot of his films, you know. But in an entirely different way than Drive My Car, for example.
Yeah, there's a languid quality to the film, too.
Yeah.
It has something in common with the second half of Drive My Car, when it's a little more meditative and contemplative, which this movie is almost all that. So that's why I was saying it's very quiet and subtle movie, maybe easy to like overlook some of the virtues hidden in there. But they're there for those that are willing to uncover them.
Yeah, and the performance by this guy who's a jack of all trades, I thought was incredible. It's just and the daughter's actually, who's like, I don't know, 10 or something, is also really great. There's some other good ones too, so worth mentioning that too, because that's also the case like with Drive My Car would not work without what the actors do there.
Right
So that's Evil Does Not Exist, which I guess all three of these movies are going to be coming to New York, I think, or
they're
something.
All in New York, in I New believe York, yeah.
Not sure if all are in Toronto though, but
no,
I was about to say they're not all competition. Hamaguchi and Vanilla.
Aggro Drift is not competition. Yeah, the other two are though.
In a category
it's
of its own
thing. Yeah, it's its own section.
Yeah, its own section. But maybe we can just quickly talk about one other movie that I think is in the Horizon section. from American filmmakers, good old American filmmakers, the Ross brothers.
Gasoline Rainbow, yeah. The new film by the Ross brothers, who made Western and Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, among other films. This is their latest, I don't know, creative nonfiction, we can call it, I suppose, although it is essentially a fiction. They are following a group of teenagers who live in Wiley, Oregon, I believe, and they're taking a kind of end of school road trip to the coast, which I think is like a 5-day journey. They have a van. And so it's basically following these kids in documentary-esque style on their trip, and they essentially meet many random folks along the way and get into little adventure / situations. But as often with the Ross brothers, I feel like it's the process is kind of the thing more than the story, the narrative. The narrative is what it is. It's kind of like almost a coming of age type film. They're going on this journey and they're all friends, and you know, they end up at some epiphany kind of at the end. But they're kind of way working with like these actual kids who are playing themselves in these fictionalized versions of themselves. It's very interesting where they kind of, I guess, stage sequences of their own creation or of their own lives. And you get to learn about their real lives as it goes along. It's very, you know, one of them comes from an immigrant family and their dad has been deported. One of them comes from like a broken home of some sort. So you get these kind of emotional scenes when they're high or stoned or drunk or something. So you get to kind of they open up about certain things as the film goes along. And yeah, it's very low key, beautiful movie. And yeah, I had a good time with that. I don't feel like it didn't strike me as like a major, bigger film, like a Western or a Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets for some reason. It's much kind of just in, it's sort of similar to their early films that dealt with young people in small communities. So in that sense, I got that vibe more. So
yeah, that makes sense.
But I do know that they wanted to bring the film to a festival that's not going to kind of shuttle it into the documentary sidebar. Right. You know, they normally premiere in Sundance or play a True False or things like this in their documentary competitions. And they're not making documentaries, so at least not in a traditional sense. So I think they were happy to kind of hopefully not get this film pigeonholed kind of out of the gate.
I agree. I think it almost ends up being a disservice to their films when they get thought of in that direction as being coming out of, as being documentary with staged elements or something. I think it's the other direction is more helpful to think of it as, you know, because the problem is you get into these kind of circular conversations about what staging means and what the integrity of it or whatnot. I think it's a bit better just to say, like, they use those tools to make this story.
Right.
And I really liked the series of encounters they have, you know. And, in fact, if I thought of the movie as a documentary, I'd feel it was kind of, like, mannered and feel a little, you know, worked over. But if I think of it as, oh, they made this, you know, road movie with a van full of, you know, teenagers, then it's actually more appealing to me.
yeah, for sure. And it's interesting to think, like, I apparently had, like, a super tiny crew. Obviously, they're filming in, like, a van with these, like, five kids. I think it was very, like, I think shot right out of the pandemic. So it was kind of, like, inspired by that time and these kids living through that time period as well, who wanted to kind of get out and explore the world after the pandemic. And, yeah, they meet all these interesting characters along the way that they go to parties with or they go to bars with, play pool. So, yeah, it's not like an overly dramatic or, like, you know, profound film in that way. But it's very, has some, like, subtle insights into, like, teenagers and friendship and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and feels like it's also just finding these pockets of the world or just people happily living their own way, you know, whether it's, like, I don't know, at one point they're, like, riding the rails, basically.
Yeah, they do. They jump on a train at one point and take a train to the next part of town.
With a couple of, like, latter-day postmodern hobos. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Or then another time they're, like, they stay, I don't know, at this house on the water, like these...
With the metalheads or whatever they are, yeah.
These like, amiable metalheads, you know, just telling stories.
Yeah, I kept thinking there was going to be, like, they're going to run into some, like, bad trouble, but they don't really do... There was one point early on where they get their car, like, kind of under the tires were stolen or something. That was, like, the big kind of dramatic moment, which forces them to, you know, go to a different part of town and, you know, reconvene and go in another direction. That's why they get on the train, I believe. But nothing overly dramatic or, like, tragic occurs. But it has its charms, and
That's Gasoline Rainbow. Yeah. What more can you say? Gasoline Rainbow, actually sort of a good description for the visuals of Aggro Drift, in a way.
It is, yeah.
But there you have it, a pretty wide variety of movies right there. Aggro Drift, The Beast, Evil Does Not Exist, and Gasoline Rainbow. Maybe we can bring it in for a landing there. There's still a couple things to see. Anything you're looking forward to that you still have yet to see?
I'm seeing the Richard Linklater tonight, which I'm always excited for. Richard Linklater, another Hitman movie, literally called Hitman.
Yes.
There's been three, I guess, with the Fincher film and Aggro Drift. That's the theme of the festival.
Yeah, it's a little unnerving.
Yeah, exactly. That's about for big titles for me. Or the Agnieszka Hollands tomorrow morning.
Yes, a green border. Yeah, some kind of immigration drama of some sort. Very curious about that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to have your inaugural podcast at Venice.
Yeah, thank you.
The first of many, I'm sure.
Hopefully.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.